Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's speech today in Minneapolis in front of a backdrop of police officers where he kicked off his public campaign to reduce gun violence in America. Lawrence Jacobs, the Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota, joins us to discuss what steps have been taken to reduce gun violence in Minnesota and whether the President can get enough of the public behind him to stand up to the NRA. Then we will speak with one of the leading authorities on the delivery of power to large populations, David Freeman, the former head of the TVA, New York Power, and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Following the half-hour blackout in the middle of the Super Bowl, we will discuss our dependence on electricity from an aging grid that will be subject to more and more stress in the future from extreme weather caused by global warming that is in turn caused by, to a great extent, by the use of coal to generate electricity. Then finally, we will speak with the organizer of a public campaign, My Jihad, which seeks to recapture the proper meaning of the word jihad that has been expropriated by Muslim and anti-Muslim extremists alike. Ahmed Rahab, the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, joins us to discuss his campaign that has already begun with advertisements in subways and on buses in Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
And the city that was once called Murderapolis, because of its high homicide rate in the 1990s, was chosen by the president to sort of kick off his public campaign to try and get enough people to have enough wind at his back so that he can get some parts or something related to gun control passed in this Congress. Tell us what took place over the years in Minneapolis to attract the president to make his stand there and also pay homage, if you will, to what Minnesota's doing.
Well, Minnesota, as you mentioned, there was an explosion of violence related to drugs and to gangs, and it was a pretty widespread set of local efforts in the communities. Nonprofits got involved. And then in terms of the city, there was a series of programs that tried to rehabilitate young people who had committed violent crimes. The result is we've had a pretty significant drop by more than a third in violent crimes in Minneapolis since the mid-1990s. It's a perfect backdrop for the president's message today that we can't do it all, but we should do something.
And he certainly had a phalanx of police officers behind him. I guess today would have been a good day for a crime if you're a felon in Minneapolis, right? That looked like every cop was there in the background.
Yeah, there's pretty broad support in Minnesota among the sheriffs and the police for common sense efforts to rein in the availability of drugs. For instance, near where the president was giving his talk, during the summer, the police were picking up about a gun a day on average. And the police don't see that as a good story. So they're looking for ways in which we can make further progress in Minnesota to rein in that availability of guns.
Well, I was speaking the other day to a filmmaker, an author, who made the film The Interrupters, which was a PBS Frontline special on a group of ex-gang members in Chicago that try to stop violence, gang-related and gun violence in the south side of Chicago. And he pointed out that almost all the guns that the police pick up, the so-called crime guns, in this tremendous amount of fratricide going on inside in the inner city community there in Chicago, Most of them, over 50%, according to the police, are bought in the outer suburbs of Chicago, and most of them at one particular gun dealer's shop. But the reason that the police can't go after these gun dealers is because the NRA has made it all but impossible for the ATF to trace, track, and share information with other law enforcement organizations about crime guns.
Well, this is certainly one of the areas where the president is focused in terms of background checks that would be universal, the banning of assault weapons, the limits on the magazines that are used for the assault weapons and other guns. And, you know, I think in Minnesota, which is very important to state, lots of folks here are hunters. This is a state that really takes pride in its very large rural areas. Hunting and fishing are very widespread. So this is not about Second Amendment, but you have the police and the sheriffs who said, you know, we're at war in some of these cities and some of the other areas. We need help. And so we're not going to have a, you know, kind of the perfect solution. But as we've seen in the last couple decades in Minneapolis, there's some things you can do that make a difference.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. Let's turn to one of your books, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community. The president, of course, is trying to mobilize the majority of the American community. In a recent poll, 92% of Americans supported broader background checks. And in that same survey, found that 53% support a ban on automatic, semi-automatic weapons, and that 63% would support limits on ammunition magazines. How does the president organize a majority community in this country to give him the wind at his back that he needs to take on the National Rifle Association, whose members are quite zealous? There may be only 4 million of them, which is about 1% of the population. But my understanding is that the pro-gun control people don't have anything like the passions of the anti-gun control people. And that the anti-gun control people, this is a single issue to them. So if you cross them, you'll never get their vote. Whereas the pro-gun control people are interested in a panoply of issues. One among them being gun control.
Well, I think that's certainly true. That the intensity is very much on the side of, particularly the leadership of the NRA. It's interesting, some of the items you mentioned, such as background checks that would be broadened. There are a good number of NRA members who support that. After all, you know, they could become victims, and they don't want people who, for a variety of reasons, have already demonstrated that they've got evil in their heart. So I think what's interesting here is, in a way, there's a kind of a battle going on between America and this one organization. The president's trying to rally support around the country to make it demonstrable and very visible, as he was doing today in Minneapolis, to bring pressure on members of Congress to step up and take some votes against the NRA. There's a lot of paranoia out among members of Congress that the NRA is a potent force if you turn on them. The evidence is actually more mixed on that.
Well, give us some of that evidence, if you could, Lawrence Jacobs.
Well, for instance, in Minnesota, we have had some politicians who have stood up to the NRA, have gone on to win re-election. You know, it's based on other issues when the elections roll around. Of course, you remember back in the 1990s, Bill Clinton actually pushed through some significant efforts to regulate guns, and there were no real backlash from the NRA. So the NRA has got a very loud bark, but its electoral bite is quite a bit less.
But the president's only chance of getting anything through the Congress rests with the Senate. where he can then hope he can get the Senate, at least if the Republicans don't invoke the filibuster rule, which they've done a lot. And apparently Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell have made some kind of deal, although people aren't quite sure what it is. And those that wanted filibuster return to go back to before the 60-vote threshold was required seem to be quite disappointed by whatever this deal is. But nevertheless, it seems that the president has Harry Reid and the Democratic-controlled Senate to work with, and the only hope in the House is if you could at least get an agreement on an up or down vote. There's enough Democrats in it, with a few wavering Republicans, you may be able to pass something. That was the way that the fiscal cliff deal was done, and that seems to be, I would think, the only legislative blueprint the president has at his disposal. Would you agree?
You know, I think that could be the way this plays out, that you see legislation moving from the Senate. But I also think if you listen very carefully to the president and to Democratic leaders, what they're saying is we're going to find an area where Democrats and Republicans could come together. And it looks as if that area is going to be on broadening the background checks, probably the ban on assault weapons and the efforts to limit the capacity of the magazines. Won't make it very far. So I think, you know, the president is very clear today. He kept saying, we may not be able to do everything we want, but it's still worth doing something, because even if we can save one life, that makes a difference. So I think there's a kind of invitation to compromise that the president has delivered today in Minneapolis.
Well, I was going to say that that Harry Reid took down off his website the endorsement he had from Wayne LaPierre, who gave him an award for Harry Reid's stance on fighting the assault weapons bill and on being a staunch supporter of the assault weapons ban. He comes, of course, from a gun-toting state, Nevada. So. And beyond his own personal views, I'm sure Harry Reid's also very sensitive to some of the other Democrats in rural states that have a strong presence for the NRA. So how does explain to me then why you think the assault weapons ban isn't likely to pass. I assume that that has something to do with what we're just talking about here.
Yes, I think the there are going to be some moderate Democrats, whether it's Harry Reid or Senator Manchin from West Virginia, who are going to draw a line in the sand saying we're willing to move forward on this, but only so far. Even Barbara Boxer has come out and said that she doesn't consider the ban on assault weapons something that's going to happen this year. And the president is basically saying the same thing in general terms, that he doesn't want to see something go down, perhaps because it's filibustered. He wants to get something to pass. And if it's the broader background checks, maybe a few other things, he would be, you know, he'd take that and then try to build on it in coming months and years.
But so how does this work, though, in American politics, where you have a very, very vocal minority that seems to be able to, up until now, thwart the majority? And there was, of course, an assault weapon ban that expired recently, and it wasn't renewed under George W. Bush. It had a 10-year sunset, which was apparently slipped in the bill as they made these last-minute compromises forced by the NRA. So I'm just curious to know, as a political scientist, you know, this strikes me as minority rule gone mad.
Well, there's no doubt that powerful, well-organized interests have disproportionate power. And you can just go around the horn. You know, we just went through and still going through this tremendous recession that's left so many people out of work or underemployed, their assets stripped. And, you know, you look at what happened with the regulation of finance, and what was passed was watered down. Much of the Dodd-Frank legislation has not actually been implemented yet. So, yes, the powerful who are able to organize, put money into lobbying, into campaign finance, have a big advantage. But I would not take that to the other direction of saying, well, therefore, majorities don't matter. Because you do see when there are persistent sets of reformers who are smart, you do see inroads. And I think the 1990s with Bill Clinton and his success in passing gun regulation is one example. Health reform is another. I mean, that was resisted by private insurers and many others, and that was passed. So there is an advantage for the organized, but they don't, I think, dictate at the end of the day.
So, Lawrence Jacobs, tell us about the mayor of Minneapolis, R.T. Ryback Jr., who spoke today ahead of the president and really was pretty tough in a way that you don't often hear Democrats going after their fellow Democrats. He said, "I don't think any of us should accept anything other than complete efforts and knocking off the political wimpsmanship that I think too often takes place around these issues. Get a spine, get a backbone, because people are losing their lives." That was a pretty strong challenge to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, RT is a real stemwinder. He's not cantankerous in person. He's very, very pleasant in person. But in the political environment, he'll throw a punch. And on issues he cares about, he can be quite ferocious. Remember, this is a guy who's been in office for some time, and he is very active, very present in Minneapolis. He has been to the homes of many, many young people who have lost their lives to gun violence. Just this summer, there was a five-year-old who was fatally shot in his home. The bullet came through the house and hit him and killed him. And the mayor was there, and that is just one of many cases. So this is an issue that the mayor cares about passionately. He's lived it. And I think, you know, he's channeling some of the outrage that some folks who support much tougher gun laws are feeling and expressing. That's part of why the president made his visit, was to give a platform to some of those, you know, outraged American citizens and politicians.
Well, it seems an odd strategy, though, that his best chances might be to beat up on his own Democrats who are wavering and give them some backbone. I imagine it's going to be tough appealing to House Republicans.
Yeah, but a little bit of, you know, kind of populist pressure from the Prairie puts a little bit of a push in the back of Democratic politicians who think they may get a pass on an issue. And I think what RT was trying to convey is, you know, don't think this is going to be one of those issues that you're able to kind of finesse and wiggle your way out of. We're watching you.
Well, just in closing, you think, Lawrence Jacobs, that there's a chance, at least in terms of the in criminal background checks, it currently only covers about 60% of all gun sales. So you got 40% of gun sales that are unregulated already. Also, semantics seem to be very important to me. For example, the abortion battles, in many ways, the labeling pro-choice versus pro-life is very disadvantageous to those who support abortion rights, because pro-choice sounds sort of somewhat capricious compared to pro-life, which has more heft. And it seems to me that framing it around gun control is a terrible piece of semantics. Why can't they talk about gun safety or something else?
Yes, and it's a very good point. I think you've touched on something. What the president was doing today, and you commented on it at the outset, was to surround himself with sheriffs and folks in the police forces. What he's talking about is pro-safety. And he's doing everything he can to distance the effort to regulate guns from the kind of social liberalism that was often seen in the 80s and 70s and 60s that really was offensive to some people who, grew up hunting and found the campaigns to be offensive. So I think the president understands what you're talking about. If you listen to his language, it really is much more inclusive. He's very careful to acknowledge that there are differences. He talks a lot about looking for some steps of change, even if it's not the kind of ideal reform strategy that he would like to see.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a leading authority on the delivery of power to large populations, and it's because it wasn't Beyoncé's fault why the power went out at the Super Bowl.
But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, they got something to say.
Now they're turning us into monsters, turning us into fire, turning us into monsters, it's all desire.
To be
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the air of federal official since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter, headed the New York Power Authority and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. He's the author of Winning Our Energy Independence and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, I'm glad to be with you again.
And we introduced you there with You Light Up Our Life. You've been lighting up a lot of people's lives for decades.
Well, I had the great privilege of having the lights stay on in Los Angeles when they dimmed throughout the rest of the state and back during the energy crisis. And that was probably my best days as a utility executive. I mean, we actually got some positive press then. Other than people just expect the lights to stay on, and they get very angry if you raise the rates or if there's ever a blackout. So, but that's just the way it goes with the turf. But this blackout issue is not something to be laughed at. It should be a growing concern, because we are now in the age of climate change, and that's a fundamentally different situation than we've lived through the last 100 years.
I want to get to that, David Freeman, but just to the 33-minute power outage in the third quarter on Sunday, Super Bowl, seen all around the world, a record number of people saw it. It struck me at the time that this is a bit embarrassing for the entire country. This is sort of third world that's happening here, and you know, we have all this paranoia about terrorism, etc. Obviously, it was apparently quickly determined by the police and the other authorities that this was a power issue, not a public safety terrorism issue. But just in general, do you think that this is a national embarrassment, and it should make people both realize how much they depended upon electricity, and two, how vulnerable the grid is?
Well, it was just the revenge of the utility, you know. People have been bashing the utilities. Well, we just wanted to show people that we could wipe out the Super Bowl. I mean, that we're pretty, I'm only half jesting, but I mean, the plain truth of the matter is a dramatic example of how utterly and completely dependent our whole economy is on reliable electricity. And I think it was healthy that we had probably the largest number of viewers that you can get on television any one time to see that the lights can go out and remind them, because we've had this terrible catastrophe on the East Coast here where people were without power for weeks. And I think the public is large, except for those poor folks that still don't have power back. Everybody else has forgotten about it. And this is our fundamental problem. You know, our attention span is about like the as long as a bolt of lightning. And this is a problem that if we don't fix, it's just going to happen again and again and again, because we're now in an era where the storms are stronger, more frequent, and more violent. And we have a grid that was built over a 100-year period that's going to be blown down more often.
So in terms of what happened at the Super Bowl, the company involved is Entergy, which is the local electric company. And apparently the power outage was a result of a problem in one of the two feeder lines that power the stadium from an external substation. Is that...
We have a 100-year-old industry. I mean, the electric grid is kind of in about maybe somewhat better shape, but about the same shape as the rest of our infrastructure. And this was a pretty sizable load, all the lights on at one time, and they just hadn't done the maintenance, the repair work. They hadn't upgraded the system to carry the load. I mean, I remember the first big blackout. I was at the Federal Power Commission. This is in 1963, I think. And it was caused by the fact that no one had adjusted the relays on the lines going north of Niagara, and it hit a certain point and just... as a protection measure, the transmission line cut off, and the power turned around and surged all through New York and New England and knocked out all the power plants. Well, we've done a lot to improve things since then, but it's the same old phenomenon that if you don't keep the system up, you're going to have blackouts. Now, I know this sounds counterintuitive and almost revolutionary, but electric rates are too low in America. They are regulated rather well by public utility commissions, and the margin of profit the utilities make is quite reasonable and well regulated. The oil companies have taken this to the cleaners, and they've made all the money. They've used all these profits in part to figure out how to dig deeper, drill deeper, and go faraway places. And now we've got more and more oil and gas to contaminate the air and put carbon up there. And yet the solar power and the wind power that would be economic today if electric power prices were 10 or 15% higher are not going forward at the pace that they need to. So, electric power is now the real lifeblood of not only our entire economy, but every home has computers and things. Every home is a business in a sense now. And when the lights go out, the economy in that place goes down to zero and stays zero. And if we just did the economics, it would certainly be a good investment to provide backup power sources, hopefully renewable, for everyone. That doesn't mean we won't continue to use the system we have, but when it breaks down, there ought to be a backup for everybody, not just the rich people that go out and buy generators for themselves, and not just the office buildings that have backups. But, I mean, everybody. And we need to start thinking those terms. And that means we need to pay a bit more for electricity because it would be cost-effective to do so.
Again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Jimmy Carter, headed the New York Power Authority and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. He's the author of Winning Our Energy Independence and Energy Insider Shows How. So you pointed out the aging grid will be subject to more and more stress in the future from extreme weather caused by global warming. And the irony is that global warming is in turn caused to a great extent by the use of coal to generate electricity, particularly in China. Where do we stand with eliminating that? Because that's a stationary source that we...
Well, let me tell you where we're standing. Until we start showing some leadership in America, we don't have anything to say to the Chinese. I mean, all the carbon that's up there now was put up there, almost all of it was put up there by America and Europe. And the Chinese are just beginning their development. We've been polluting up there for the last 30 or 40 years. So until America starts phasing out coal and fossil fuels in a big way, I just don't think the Chinese are going to pay any attention to us.
So what can be done then in terms of what I'm getting from you, David Freeman, is that if you have these big grids like the one you just described that went out in New York in the 60s, the alternative surely would be to decentralize power, would it not?
Well, I think at this stage of the game, we can just supplement the grid by building kind of local mini grids. I mean, just like an office building. An office building has a generator that sits there and does nothing, you know, 90% of the time. But if there's a power shortage, they burn diesel oil and keep the lights on. Well, the generator could burn hydrogen, and the hydrogen could be made from solar power. But we can provide those kind of backups on a neighborhood basis and throughout the country because... when the lights go out, the damage is so great and the suffering is so intense, and it's going to happen so much more often in the future that we've got to deal with that. That would just mean paying a little bit more for electricity, but it would be more than worth it. I mean, if you just count up how much money the cost of these blackouts are and how much hardship they are, it's an easy decision to make on a financial basis.
Now, this technology, we know certainly solar exists, and big companies have plenty of roof spaces, and one of the ways to get around the global warming, I've been told by scientists, is that if everybody painted their roof white in the world, that would do a lot to reflect the sun back because the polar ice caps have done that.
Conservation has got to be a part of it, but you need some energy. I mean, you can't conserve down to zero because it takes something to keep warm in the winter and to run the air conditioner. So it's got to be made. Electricity has to be made out of solar, wind, and with storage to back it up. But a generator can burn hydrogen just as easily as it burns diesel. And there's a lot of, and we know how to separate the hydrogen from the water. We do it with a machine called an electrolysis machine that's 90-some-odd% efficient, and we can use the solar power. In effect, we would store the solar power in the form of hydrogen and use it only when it's needed. So even if it were a bit more expensive, it wouldn't matter because the lights will stay on most of the time. But this backup, if it's economic, you know, for hospitals and office buildings, then many grids in the neighborhood could be equally cost-effective. It's just a change of mindset. We have to realize that the grid is going to be a lot more vulnerable to outages from storms, and especially here on the East Coast, but all over the country. I mean, we're in a new era, and we've got to start adjusting to it, or we will pay a heavy price. I mean, I don't know how many episodes like what we faced a few months ago we can tolerate in this country.
Well, David Freeman, of course, the idea that we should spend money on alternatives and raise electric rates to do so is not certainly something politicians seem to have the courage to put forth.
Well, they can't seem to decide the time of day, so let's just put them aside.
Right. But meanwhile, enormous resources and money are going into nuclear power, for example. And we have an example down here south of us at San Onofre, north of San Diego.
It's pretty clear that we need to retire those aging nuclear plants before they kill us. They're Fukushima-type designs, and many of them are near-earthquake faults. There's radioactive trash that's piled up for 30 years, and they're not really that cost-effective anymore. So, but we have the technology to replace them. We just haven't made the decision to do so. I mean, at the San Onofre plant, we've gotten a major assist in shutting the plant down from the engineers at the Edison Company, who really badly screwed up the design of new steam generators to the point where they're not functioning, even though they're only 2 years or 1 year old, and that plant needs to be replaced by the solar and wind and storage that's coming online. I mean, actually, the electric power loads are not growing hardly at all now, and until we get electric cars in mass quantities, they're probably not going to grow. But between efficiency and load management and bringing on the solar and wind and storage, we can replace the nuclear plants over a period of several years. But we got to start right now before we have a Fukushima-type accident. And I can tell you that we need to start recognizing that there's all this radioactive trash is piled up for 30 years. It's sitting there, most of it in swimming pools, and if they lose the water, and there's no containment, so they're out there in the open. If they lose the water, you have a radioactive fire. It's the equivalent of a meltdown. And at least let's put those spent fuels into dry concrete casts for the time being, because there's no other answer. But we need to exercise birth control. We need to stop making stuff that's going to be radioactive for thousands of years, and we don't know where to put it. Now, you know, the climate change challenge is no greater than the threat of atomic power. And there is no such thing as a peaceful atom. And the plain truth of the matter is it's time to end the love affair with nuclear power, which is morphed into a religion for certain people, because, as a matter of fact, on a cost basis, even natural gas, which is poison, also is cheaper than nuclear power. So if you're going to have poison anyhow, you might as well have the cheapest. But we shouldn't have either one of them. The future ought to be all solar, wind, with storage to make it available around the clock. We're doing it in California, and we're going to be at 33% by 2020. And the governor already mentioned going to 40%. I think California is leading the way, frankly, perhaps in the whole world. But the rest of the world needs to join them, and we need to continue on a march to 100% renewable. I have a very simple law that I think ought to be passed. We ought to just pass a law that's saying that these polluters ought to reduce greenhouse gas pollution 3% a year. And to the extent that they fail to make that goal, there'll be a very heavy tax on the amount by which they failed to meet the goal, and that money could not be passed on to the consumer. It has to be absorbed by the stockholder. If we could pass such a law, we would be on the road to a carbon-free, a nuclear-free energy supply where our grandchildren might be able to live a much happier life than otherwise.
Well, just in closing, David Freeman, surely it would take, since the technology is old and we spend we're willing to throw good money after bad with nuclear power, but we don't appear to be willing to build a sufficiently big solar plant that would power a whole city to show that this technology has been around forever can actually work if you scale it up.
Well, we're actually doing a little better than that in California. They're building solar plants of several hundred megawatts now. The revolution is quietly underway. It just needs to, that flame needs to be fanned, and people need to know more about it and demand it. Frankly, the price of solar power has gone down like a rock in recent years. And if you could fund these solar projects with just 2% loans, 100% debt, it would be very economical. So what we really need to make the solar and wind revolution happen is a green bank, take a page out of the book of the REA, and loan a money at 2% interest. These projects are just like dams. They're all capital. Once they're paid for, the operating costs are next to nothing. So we can have cheaper power in the future. And the current plants are financed by private capital that's making a lot of money, and the cost of the capital averages around 10%. If you can build a plant with 2% money, you have just knocked the hell out of the cost. And we're in the revolution then is underway. We know what we need to do. We just don't have the knowledge at the grassroots level, and we don't have that old-time religion we had in the 70s when we created EPA and when Richard Nixon sounded like a member of the Sierra Club. But, you know, Barack has now said that he wants to do something. It's up to the people to make him do it.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Pleased to be here. Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter, headed the New York Power Authority and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was a state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. He's the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about my jihad. You can be also me. I just can't see the rivers we. You know what the sun's all about when the lights go out.
Is often heard from society. With conviction they preach, not even knowing of whom they speak. I guess it's each to their own. Those who won't do will know. I guess it's each to their own. It's from the top, the views of all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ahmed Rahab, who is an American Muslim activist and writer with a focus on contemporary social issues, including civil rights, media relations, and relations between Islam and the West. He is currently the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the nation's largest Muslim civil liberties and advocacy group. In 2011, he was appointed by Illinois Governor Pat Quinn as an advisor to the governor via the newly formed Illinois Muslim Advisory Council. He recently organized the public education campaign My Jihad, which seeks to share the proper meaning of the word jihad as believed and practiced by the majority of Muslims. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ahmed Rahab.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about your brainchild here. I was always struck, Ahmed, I mean, I guess it was a terrible historical irony that when 9/11 happened, the presidents of the United States were Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, and they could not have gotten off on the wrong foot on just about every aspect of the so-called war on terror. And it's always struck me as being extraordinary that the word jihadis has been chosen to describe people like bin Laden, when in fact the word criminal would have been much more appropriate, rather than dignifying them with a word that means one who's on a spiritual struggle.
That is correct. And if you think about it, language is the building block of ideas, and it's the building block of discourse. And if you have the incorrect language, the incorrect words to denote certain concepts, you will have the wrong discourse and the wrong ideas. And so that's why this notion, this whole program, excuse me, came to mind. It is reclaiming the original and true meaning of the word jihad, which is an Arabic word and an Islamic concept, not redefining it, as some have incorrectly stated. I'm not here to say, oh, I think jihad should mean X, Y, Z, and introduce a new meaning. Rather, I'm here to say it has always meant for us, not just in terms of our understanding, but in terms of our practice, our daily living. Jihad has been a struggle to get to a better place. Simply put, when confronted between two choices, an easy choice and the right choice, it is mustering the courage and the confidence and the inner strength to make the right choice. That is what jihad is, and dealing with the difficulty that comes with that. That struggle is jihad, and not terrorism, and not attacking civilians. That is counter to the spirit of jihad.
So as I was saying, Ahmed, obviously we've been wrong-footed from day one with this war on terror, and of course the Iraq War will go down in history as one of the greatest blunders. Certainly, it was described at the time by the Israeli military historian Martin van Creewald as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD. So we've had this footprint in the Arab world that's done nothing but cause anti-Americanism. So I think that the jury is certainly back in on the notion that the response to 9/11 was far more damaging than 9/11 itself. And of course, recently, since the shooting of these school children in Newtown, I was reading somewhere about the statistics of how many thousands and thousands of Americans who've been killed by guns here in the United States since 9/11, not to belittle the 3,000 deaths on 9/11. So, I mean, what you're doing now is welcome, but it's taken a while, hasn't it? I mean, come on.
Well, to be frank with you, the problem goes way back, way before 9/11 or the response to it. And I place the blame on two sides. The primary side that I blame are the actual Muslim extremists themselves who started by misdefining and misattributing the concept of jihad. They would engage in whatever narrow political work agenda that they had. They engaged in certain acts of violence that, in my opinion, in the opinion of many Muslim jurists, ran contrary to the very spirit of Islam, such as the targeting of civilians. 9/11 is just one case in point, but any act of terrorism that targets civilians is considered contrary to the Islamic spirit itself and cannot be deemed jihad or even an Islamic act to begin with. So these Muslim radicals, these Muslim extremists, we're reclaiming jihad and that term from them. But also on the other side, we're talking about the anti-Muslim extremists, those who jump quickly on the fact that these individuals are malpracticing Islam, for a lack of better terms, and point to them and say, no, these are the true representatives of Islam. This is truly Islam. Everybody should do as they do to be a true Muslim, and those who don't simply don't know their religion. And so basically what you find here, while these two extremists come from the opposite end of the spectrum, they're essentially concentric in their worldview, in their definition of jihad, that it's bloody, that it's violent, that it, you know, in the notion that there is some kind of clash of civilizations between the so-called Islam, you know, Islamdom or the Islamic world and the so-called West, and that it's irrefutable and irreversible. And they need each other to survive. The Muslim radicals point to the anti-Muslim radicals and say, look, the West hates us. They'll never like us. They always hate Islam. It's in their blood. It's in their history. It's in their legacy. We're at war forever. And the anti-Muslims will point at these Muslim radicals and say, we told you so. They're violent. They're heathens. They're savages, et cetera, et cetera. And we, the majority, myself, yourself, our friends and families included, and your listeners, are stuck in the middle between these two extremes who have been hijacking the discourse. And what this campaign is about reclaiming not only the term jihad, but the discourse itself, beginning with one of the most taboo and misdefined and misattributed terms. But we hope that it goes further into a larger movement that brings back the helm of the conversation to those who know how to create rational space. We can differ, we can disagree, but I'm sick and tired of having the conversation on Islam, you know, be whittled down to what is offensive to my very intelligence, that insults my intelligence, this dumbing down of the discourse, that Islam is somehow about, you know, blowing yourself up and getting 72 virgins in heaven, and if you make a mistake, you cut your hand, and you marry, you know, 9 wives, and, you know, they stone people. This caricature that we, you know, Aladdin, you know, the Disney movie, you know, it's just, it's offensive. And, you know, Islamophobia is not offensive to me. And I'll shut up after this. It's not offensive to me because it's a form of racism or bigotry, and I happen to be a Muslim, although that's part of the problem. But it's actually offensive to me because it's insulting to my intelligence, and I happen to be a creature of intelligence. It's just dumb.
Again, I'm speaking with Ahmed Rahab, who is an American Muslim activist and writer with a focus on contemporary social issues, including civil rights, media relations, and relations between Islam and the West. He is currently the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the nation's largest Muslim civil liberties and advocacy group. In 2011, he was appointed by Illinois Governor Pat Quinn as an advisor to the governor via the newly formed Illinois Muslim Advisory Council, and he recently organized the public education campaign My Jihad, which seeks to share the proper meaning of the word jihad as believed and practiced by the majority of Muslims. So your point's well taken that there's a symbiosis between the Muslim extremists and anti-Muslim extremists, and they both feed each other. But there are an estimated 7 to 8 million Muslims here in the United States. And they it's always struck me that just going back again to the wrong-footed Bush-Cheney or Cheney-Bush war on terror, that we, no Christian or Jew can dissuade a young Islamist from taking a more radical path. The only person that could dissuade a young Islamist would be a moderate Islamist, for the want of a better description. And I've never understood why here in the United States we didn't make it our number one national security priority to welcome American Muslims, to advertise how America integrates its Muslim populations, rather than this insane demonization that's happening with the sort of right-wing ignoramuses in various state legislatures, like I believe in Kansas and states like that, where they have banned Sharia law, when there's no such suggestion anywhere on the planet that Sharia law is about to be invoked in Kansas.
Because for some odd reason, you know, we haplessly and inadvertently decided to play the part assigned to us by Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. See, it wasn't about taking down a couple of buildings or taking away, you know, hundreds of lives, as evil and as powerful as that is and hurtful as that is. That wasn't the ultimate goal of Al-Qaeda. They know they can't win a war against 350 million people with tens of thousands of skyscrapers and high-rises and, you know, buildings in 50 states with billions and trillions of dollars by just taking down, you know, two or three or four buildings and killing 3,000 people. That's not going to ultimately destroy America. They know that. What they wanted to do, the entire idea and plan behind the Al-Qaeda action, was to create enough fear inside the hearts of Americans, primarily the government and the leaders of America, not just the political leaders, but the opinion leaders, the media leaders, the education leaders, the community and faith leaders, so that they would become disrupted from their own value system and become self-defeating and become self-collapsing. They wanted to ignite an implosion. They didn't want to take us down with an explosion. The explosion was simply the ignition from which they hoped we would self-ignite. And we began on that path. And the first thing we did on that path was to begin to chisel away at that which makes us strong and unique and powerful, and that is our own laws, our civil rights, our due process. When we began to whittle away at that, we became weaker, and we became, we began a process of self-implosion. Because if we don't have a constitution that respects the rights of all Americans, and you don't have the home of the free, home of the brave, then what's the point of all the songs and the, you know, and all the paraphernalia, right? I mean, that's what we celebrate, and they were taking that away from us, but causing us to do it ourselves. And all it took was to instigate enough fear. And it was as if Bush had accepted the position or the role assigned to him, explicitly so, as did Cheney, because every time they came on television for a good number of years, they were talking about terrorism, this terrorism, that, the terrorists, the terrorists, the terrorists. And people want, at one point in time, you know, a lot of us forget, Ian, but I have a memory, a good memory. You know, the duct tape days. Remember those days? Duct tape. People were duct taping their windows.
All right.
You know, they were afraid of these attacks, and they were filling their pantries with dry food, and they were getting ready for the next, you know, alien invasion. And we were just like a stampede. It was like we're stampeding all over our values and our principles and our, you know, our courage and our vision for what we wanted to do and live. And we began, you know, the canary in the coal mine were the Muslim community.
Well,
things.
I'm afraid we've run out of time here. I want to talk to you about your campaign. With now you've got billboards up in subways and buses in Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., but we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ahmed Rahab, who is an American Muslim activist and writer who focuses on contemporary social issues, including civil rights, media relations, and relations between Islam and the West. He is currently the executive director of the Chicago Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the nation's largest Muslim civil liberties and advocacy group. In 2011, he was appointed by Illinois Governor Pat Quinn as an advisor to the governor via the newly formed Illinois Muslim Advisory Council. He recently organized the public education campaign My Jihad, which seeks to share the proper meaning of the word jihad as believed and practiced by the majority of Muslims. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.